From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Terry Gross is off for a couple of days. You'd think by the title that the book Possession is a trashy romance novel. Far from it, it's a best-selling romance with a literary bent. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with British novelist A.S. Byatt about writing passionate romances for bookish readers. Also, writer and med student Ethan Kanan tells us about his new novel, Blue River. His first book of short stories won critical acclaim when Kanan was only 27. And commentator Maureen Corrigan gives us her best argument for why poetry is still important. Two new collections by poets Adrienne Rich and Seamus Heaney. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir continues to resist calls to trade land for peace and to end Jewish settlement in the occupied territories. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Today, in remarks to the General Assembly of the Council of Jewish Federations in Baltimore, the Prime Minister said if the peace process is to succeed, both sides must invest effort, energy, and goodwill. But there was little hint of compromise in the Prime Minister's words. Three times in the past, Israel has returned captured territory, he said. How often do we have to retreat from areas taken in wars of survival? And the Prime Minister dismissed Palestinian hopes for an independent state.
There is simply no room for two states in such a small area.
Those listening to the Prime Minister, major Jewish American contributors to the State of Israel, applauded frequently, but a recent poll of the board of the Council of Jewish Federations shows a majority opposing the Prime Minister's policy of expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank, and a majority supporting trading land for peace, despite what the Prime Minister might say. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Diplomats at the United Nations say that Egyptian Deputy Prime Minister Boutros Ghali of Egypt led today's Security Council balloting for the next UN Secretary General. Ghali is said to have received 11 yes votes and 4 abstentions from the 15-member Security Council. The other major candidate was Bernard Chidzero, the finance minister of Zimbabwe. If he's chosen, Ghali would replace Peru's Javier Perez de Cuellar, who retires at the end of the year. Perez de Cuellar has served 2 5-year terms. Officials of the United States and Iran are near agreement on compensation for undelivered American-made military equipment dating from before Iran's 1979 revolution. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
The accord under negotiation at The Hague would be an important step towards settling financial differences between the two countries and improving relations. The long-awaited agreement coincides with the release of 2 American hostages by Iranian-backed groups in Lebanon. The Bush administration maintains resolution of the Iranian assets dispute is unrelated to the fate of the hostages. Officials say progress has been possible because of concessions by Iran, reflecting Tehran's eagerness to open the way to better relations with the West. The compensation agreement involves $250 million worth of Iranian-owned, American-made military equipment that was in the United States for repair or training exercises at the time of the revolution. Other large claims remain unresolved, but U.S. officials say each side got something out of this one. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 3 points to close at 2,932.69. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A Kurdish rebel leader said today that Kurdish forces have killed about 100 Iraqi soldiers in a battle near the northern Iraqi town of Sulaymaniyah. The report could not be independently confirmed. The official, Sercil Kazaz, told reporters in Ankara, Turkey, that Iraqi tanks were shelling Kurdish villages and bringing more troops into the region. Iranian radio said today that Saddam Hussein's army has given the Kurds 2 weeks to hand over their weapons. A federal judge in Miami has denied a government request to resume Haitian repatriation. The Haitians are fleeing their own country following 2 months of unrest. The ruling means the Haitian boat people will remain in U.S. custody at least until next Wednesday. More from Doug Phillips in Miami.
The ruling ruling also means that between now and next week's scheduled court hearing, attorneys for the Haitian Refugee Center in Miami will be allowed to visit with the refugees aboard Coast Guard cutters and at Guantanamo Bay to collect evidence. Refugee Center attorney Ira Kurzban is ready for the worst.
I think you're going to find very sick people. I think you're going to find people who are really in distress from being out on the Coast Guard cutters for so long. I mean, if you look at the government's own affidavits, they say there's been fights on board. They're not sure they can control the situation. They say the people are in bad health.
At least 3,000 Haitians are in U.S. custody at sea, and indications are that the exodus from Haiti is continuing. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
The House voted today to replenish the Federal Deposit Insurance Fund, the account that backs the bank accounts of 110 million American savers. The measure passed on a vote of 344-84 after it was stripped of some controversial Bush administration proposals to overhaul the banking industry. The bill also didn't contain a limit on credit card interest rates that was approved by the Senate last week. The measure does contain some provisions tightening regulation of banks. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Wow, is what Fresh Air critic Maureen Cargan said after she finished the novel Possession by British author A.S. Byatt. Maureen wasn't the only one. Critics and readers loved the book when it came out last year. The vintage paperback edition is now available. Maureen described the book as part romance, part detective story, part fairy tale, academic farce, and gothic thriller. The novel is mostly about an illicit love affair between two Victorian poets. A century later, a young scholar named Roland Mitchell discovers the affair when he finds their love letters. Roland consults feminist scholar Maud Bailey, and together they begin a search for the real story. But Roland feels guilty about reading Ash's private letters. Byatt says she's been the object of literary detectives herself and thinks scholars should feel a little guilty.
I have become, as I have got more and more to the point where people actually do want to buy my notebooks, to the point of feeling some considerable hatred towards biographical explorers. Another thing, I was sitting in a seminar in University College talking about W.H. Auden, who destroyed a lot of things before he died, and changed a lot of his poems before he died and destroyed some drafts. And one of my scholarly colleagues was in a terrible rage. He said he had no right to do this. And I said, what do you mean, no right? They were his. But that was the difference. I saw myself as a writer, and he saw himself as a person, a biographer, a scholar, a critic, whose duty it was to preserve these documents for the public. But he wasn't interested in the rights of the man who wrote them.
Is that what Possession is about?
It's one of the things Possession is about. It's about the way in which the biographer particularly, in a ghoulish way, at various points the biographers in the novel are called ghouls and scavengers and sort of hyenas, takes over people's lives. I think this was just beginning to happen in the 19th century, and George Eliot herself has a wonderful letter which I twist about and reuse in the novel about the awfulness of realizing that people had been through Dickens's desk and printed all those notes he thought was private. Though it's taken until now that Claire Tomlin has actually pieced together his love affair with Helen Ternan because he hid it. But that you have to start hiding your life in strange ways, and this isn't good either.
I'd love to have you read a section from the book here, and this is on page 162, where Roland and Maud have a kind of encounter.
Ah, yes, this is a section where Roland and Maud meet outside a bathroom in a mock Gothic Victorian mansion, in which they've discovered another cache of letters, and they're, one should say, hostile to each other. Maud has been very cold and chilly towards Roland. And Roland rather likes Maud, or would like her if she would unbend and be nice to him, but she won't. And he has been, they've both had to stay overnight because it's snowing. And he has been very, very careful to leave her the bathroom so that she can get washed in her privacy long enough. The whole story also is haunted by the image of the fairy Melusina, who was a fairy, who was a woman above the waist and a serpent below the waist, and thus an image of sort of female androgyny. And she was discovered by her husband in a bathroom. He was told never to look at her on a Saturday, and one day when they'd been married enough to bring up 12 children, he did peer through the keyhole and saw that she was this, and then she had to leave him. So there's a game going on with bathrooms all through my novel. I think this is all I need to explain.
Okay.
When Roland came along the corridor in the silence, he thought he had been clever. The heavy latch door was dark inside its stone arch. There was no sound of plashing or flushing. He was then seized with doubt as to whether the bathroom was in fact empty. How could any sound penetrate that solid oak? He did not want to rattle a locked door and embarrass both her and himself. So he went down on one knee on the carpet and put his eye to the huge keyhole, which glinted at him and disconcertingly vanished as the door swung back and he smelt wet freshness, steam in cold air. She nearly fell over him there. She put out a hand to steady herself on his shoulder, and he threw up a hand and clasped a narrow haunch under the silk of the kimono. And there it was, what Randolph Henry Ashe had called the kick galvanic, the stunning blow like that emitted by the moray eel from under its boulders to unsuspecting marine explorers. Roland got somehow on his feet, briefly clutching the silk and letting it go as though it stung. Her hands were pink and slightly damp. The fringes of the pale hair were damp, too. It was down, he saw the hair, running all over her shoulders and neck, swinging across her face, which he meekly supposed would be furious, and saw when he looked, was simply frightened. Did she simply emit the electric shock, he wondered, or did she also feel it? His body knew perfectly well that she felt it. He did not trust his body. I was looking if there was a light, so as not to disturb you, if you were in there. I see. The blue silk collar was dampish too. The whole thing appeared in this half-light to be running with water, all the runnels of silk twisted about her body by the fiercely efficient knot in which she had tied her sash. Below the silk hem were the ruffled, mundane edge of pink winsette and slippered sharp feet. I waited some time for you to use the bathroom, she said, conciliatory. So did I. No harm done, she said. No. She held out her wet hand. He took it and felt its chill and the subsidence of something. Good night, then, she said. Good night.
A.S. Byatt reading from her novel Possession. I love that passage, and I guess it's the both the attention to the detail, the tension. Here they are, two heady academics poring over love letters, and that galvanic or that kind of response.
Yes, I was pleased when I got that phrase into Randolph Ashe's little poem about the kick galvanic, because galvanic is a word that the Victorians used all over the place because they had just discovered that if you gave a dead frog an electric shock, it moved. Mm. And, of course, my whole thing is about bringing things to life with giving them shocks. So it works in all sorts of directions, that word. And at the same time, it is sort of purely romantic at one level, those two people touching each other and feeling a shock. And it is what does happen to people.
Well, there's something wonderful about even the looking through the keyhole.
It's a very ancient fairy tale motif. I mean, the number of stories of one kind and another there are of the prohibition against looking through the keyhole and then the person looking and immediately losing what he sees. And you'd think he would know. I mean, they're all in the same story and they all look through it and they all lose what they see. It's interesting. I mean, Freud explained it very simply. You know, what you mustn't do is look in on your parents making love. But I think it's more complicated than that. I don't quite know what it is. I just know that you tap deep into all sorts of people's primitive responses if you use that image.
I was interested to read that when you received the Booker Prize, which is a very well-known literary prize in England, those ceremonies are televised. And it was shocking to me because I don't think we have anything where writers in this country, like an Academy Award, would receive prizes on television with an audience that watched.
It is actually, it is very beautifully orchestrated, the Booker. The name of the winner is kept a complete secret until it's announced at the end of the dinner. And various television companies have filmed the dinner in England. They also film discussions among critics, good and bad critics, about which book they think will win and about the nature of the four books. And they come to the six books. And they come to the houses of the shortlisted writers and film them describing their book. And they've even done films of scenes from the books. And I think it actually works because it's done at a very primitive level, like a horse race. And it's got a narrative. And I don't think most of the viewing public are very interested in books, but they are interested in the agony that these six writers are going through, having to eat their dinner and not know which of them is going to go up and receive the prize. And it is, it is extremely painful sitting there.
Well, you have to probably sit there and carry on a conversation with the person sitting next to you.
You do.
All the while wondering.
And every now and then the television cameras come and they make you extremely hot. And they watch you wondering. On the other hand, it is also fair to say that I do think that this kind of mixture of public discussion of literature and pure competitive sport has greatly raised the British interest in books and in writing. And people rush out and buy all the shortlisted books.
Why do you write, why do you call yourself AS?
I always meant to. There are two or three reasons. One is simply that when I started writing, I felt writers ought to be anonymous. T.S. Eliot said that poets were impersonal entities, and he wrote under T.S. Eliot, not under Tom. And he was a sort of hero, and I thought you could write under A.S. Byatt, and it has the same rhythm. Mm. Like George Eliot, I didn't want to get pigeonholed as a woman writer. But I didn't want to be thought to be a male writer. I just didn't want it to come into it. And then I also, when my eldest daughter was born, which was when I was very young, I got in a gloomy fit and I thought, Antonia is a very good name and I shall never now write a book because I am stuck in child rearing. So I gave her the name, and it is her name, and she wishes, I think, probably to write. So I stay with my initials.
So you refer to yourself as A.S.?
Yes, and so she refers to me as A.S. And I mean, my friends call me all sorts of things. but if I'm doing radio, I mean, more in my own country, I'm very, very careful to remain with my initials, which is all I can do to sort of compensate her for this idiocy of having given her this rather good name.
Can you explain a family, your family, that produced two writers, you and your sister Margaret Drabble?
It produced, in fact, five writers. My father published two novels. My younger sister has published several very good books on art history. My brother wrote a volume of Halsbury's Laws of England. It was a kind of... It was a family which was full of books. The house was full of books. It was, in a sense, narrowly bookish. Yeah. And ambitious, and both parents were ambitious, and I don't quite know why we all simply assumed we could do it. My mother, I think, could and would have written, but was a working-class woman who got as far as Cambridge University, which in her time was unknown on the whole for people like her. And I think she should have written, and sort of knew she should have done. And I think her ambition and her frustration got pushed on to the next generation. So this is a known thing that does happen. Ambitious and frustrated mothers produce even more ambitious and sometimes successful children. And I think it was that kind of paradigm.
In a New York Times Magazine profile of you, the author talked about, or you talked about your mother's unhappiness, I guess, about being able to go to Cambridge, but not being able to be, I mean, coming home and taking care of children. Did you sense her unhappiness?
Yes, I did. I think we all did. She was very, very angry most of the time. And the times when she wasn't angry was when she gave you a poetry book and discussed a poem with you. Or the time when, for instance, I said to her, I think you would like to read Henry James. I was grown up by then, but she was still angry. And she read her way all the way through Henry James and got so excited, and the same with Proust. And then she was wonderful to be with. And so I concluded that despite her saying, you know, I love having had four children, I love having brought them up, she was actually very angry that she couldn't go on thinking about literature. It was bred into her.
Did you find then that writing and reading then was a haven in your household?
Yes, it was. It was A, approved of course, and B, it was a haven. And C, I was very ill most of my childhood with one thing and another. So I spent a lot of my childhood in bed with books. And nobody stopped me reading anything except 1984, which my mother said would depress me, which when I did read it, it did. But, yes, it was partly a haven, but I think it wouldn't have been so good if it hadn't been a haven that I felt was also at some level approved of.
Yeah.
She liked to see us reading. I like to see my daughters reading, but they don't.
Mm. They don't?
Well, the eldest one does, the one who works for the Arts Council in London, but... And the middle one reads secretly, and the little one parades the fact that she never reads a book at all. She's going
Rebellion.
To be a painter. Yes. Yes, she's a very intelligent reader when she does. Hmm. I've caught her out at it now and then.
A.S. Byatt's novel Possession is now available in paperback. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz introduces us to a new recording by a great community orchestra. This is Fresh Air. Audiences usually attend community orchestra concerts because they have friends who are playing, not because they're looking for a profound musical experience. But according to classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz, the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra and its conductor Benjamin Zander are exceptions to the rule. Lloyd has a review of their first recording.
For over a decade, Benjamin Zander and the Boston Philharmonic have been giving some of the most thrilling performances of the orchestral repertory I've ever heard. Though there are a number of superb professionals playing, the extraordinary spirit of this group surely comes from the amateur players who are the heart of it. They rehearse every week, usually beginning months before a concert. And since Zander is a profound and probing musician, the players are not just learning the notes, but coming to a deep understanding of the music. Their interpretations put some world-class outfits to shame. Zander, in fact, has been a leader in the movement to restore the original tempos to classical music where metronome markings exist. Beethoven's unusually fast tempo markings, for example, were ignored for nearly 150 years. Zander's research has influenced such celebrated musicians as Roger Norrington. Last year, Zander and the Philharmonic went to work on something a little more recent, Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. A musical friend of Zander's told him that there was a piano roll of The Rite of Spring that was made in the early 20s and supervised by Stravinsky himself. The shock was that the last section, the powerful Danse Sacrale, was almost twice as fast as it's played now. Even Stravinsky's own stereo recording takes this music much more slowly. Perhaps even he had decided that his original tempo was faster than it was humanly possible to play. But Zander found the faster tempo convincing and wanted to try it in live performance. It was a stunning achievement. So many orchestras make this score sound effortless and slick. Zander restored its primeval power, and the high-speed finale was breathtaking. Now that live performance has been brilliantly transferred to compact disc. The Boston Philharmonic certainly rises to Stravinsky's technical demands. But for me, the mysterious slow sections and an overall sense of continuity are at least as crucial to a truly great performance of Stravinsky's masterpiece as the exciting fast parts. And in these matters, Zander is even more impressive. An added bonus is the inclusion for the first time on disc of the original piano roll. It was recorded at London's Dulwich College last year and performed by Rex Lawson. He's using a 1912 Aeolian push-up pianola attached to a Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, performed by Benjamin Zander and the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra on the British IMP Masters label. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moskowain with Fresh Air. Ethan Kanan is in his fourth year at Harvard Medical School, so he has a pretty bright future. But Ethan Kanan also has a pretty bright present as a writer. His collection of short stories, Emperor of the Air, was a huge critical success. Now he's just come out with his first novel. Coming up, Ethan Kanan talks with us about his two careers. And critic Maureen Cargan reviews two new reasons to read poetry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has signed the Civil Rights Act of 1991 into law, amid controversy that called into question his administration's commitment to affirmative action. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
The new civil rights law essentially reverses several Supreme Court decisions that made it difficult for minorities and women to sue their employers for alleged discrimination. The new law is the result of a compromise after the administration opposed earlier versions on the grounds that they would encourage quotas. On the eve of today's signing, White House Counsel Boyden Gray issued a draft presidential directive ordering a review and termination of all federal affirmative action programs. But the president rescinded the directive and at today's signing made his position clear.
And in that same spirit, I say again today, I support affirmative action. Nothing in this bill overturns the government's affirmative action programs.
The president also repeated his opposition to hiring quotas. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
In New York City, in voting today in the UN Security Council, Boutros Ghali of Egypt led in voting for a new secretary general. Ghali was the only one of 13 candidates to receive at least 9 votes, thus just about assuring his election. A French diplomat said that the Egyptian diplomat appears 99% certain of becoming the new UN chief at the end of the year. Ghali served 14 years as Egypt's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs before being appointed Deputy Prime Minister in May. In Prague, an estimated 40,000 people demonstrated today in support of President Havel of Czechoslovakia. Havel is campaigning against separatists who might divide the nation in the manner of Yugoslavia. Burton Bolag reports from Prague.
Tens of thousands of people gathered in Venceslav Square in the center of Prague to listen to President Havel and several other former dissidents talk about the dangers facing the country. Havel said he is not seeking a confrontation with Parliament, but wants lawmakers to basically stop fiddling around as the country moves closer to breaking up. This due to the pressure from Slovak nationalists. Today's rally capped off a week of demonstrations, some organized by students in Prague and elsewhere, following an urgent appeal by Havel last Sunday. Havel asked for extra powers, including the right to organize a nationwide referendum to let the people have a say on whether the smaller Slovak part of the country should remain in Czechoslovakia. Havel's appeal appears to be getting a surprising degree of support among the population. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 2 points to close at 2,932.69 on volume of some 195 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. The Coast Guard is now evacuating most of the 1,800 Haitian boat people from overcrowded cutters. The State Department says more than 800 people were transferred to a U.S. Navy ship, thus allowing the cutters to look for additional boat people. While the number of Haitians picked up was off sharply yesterday, officials say that seas have been rough in the area. Monday, the Coast Guard began returning the boat people to their homeland, but this was suspended by a court order in Miami. And according to news reports from Cuba, at least 16 people died, and over 100 others are missing after a boat carrying Haitian refugees went down in rough seas. The Cuban Coast Guard says that 6 people were rescued. Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin says he cannot extradite former East German leader Erich Honecker without agreement from Soviet President Gorbachev. Deidre Berger reports from Bonn.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev seems to be winning a power struggle that has broken out over the fate of former East German communist leader Erich Honecker. On a visit to Bonn, Boris Yeltsin said his government will deport Honecker from Russia, but Gorbachev has the final word on Honecker's ultimate destination. Last week, Russian justice officials said they wanted to deport Honecker to Germany, where he is charged with murder for issuing shoot-to-kill orders along the former German border. Gorbachev objected. He said it would be inhumane to deport the 79-year-old Honecker, who has asked Moscow for political asylum. Yeltsin met with Chancellor Helmut Kohl today at the beginning of a 3-day visit to Germany, his first visit abroad since the failed coup in the Soviet Union in August. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Bonn.
Mexico and the United States have signed new agreements to expand air rights between the two countries. This agreement will also encourage truck and bus safety in the two nations. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Somehow, in the middle of medical school, Ethan Kanan managed to write a collection of short stories, which was published to much critical acclaim. Emperor of the Air came out 3 years ago when Kanan was just 27 years old. But literary success and the publication of a new novel did not lure Kanan away from medical school. He began his 4th year this fall. His new novel, Blue River, is about two brothers who on the surface appear to be polar opposites. Edward is a successful ophthalmologist. Lawrence, the older brother, is a drifter. The book begins when Lawrence arrives at Edward's doorstep after a long absence. This meeting unearths past secrets and memories that shatters Edward's illusions about himself. I asked Ethan Kanan to read from the beginning of Blue River.
On a Sunday morning in the June of my 31st year, I open the front door of our house looking for the newspaper and find a man standing out there, stoop-shouldered, bent, blotch-skinned, his hair and beard tangled, staring with the big, wet eyes of an animal. Some kind of bum, I think, stepping back, half-shutting the door, until I recognize him. He stands on our porch, not moving. Not moving, I stand inside. In his gloved hand, he holds the paper I have come out to find, bright from the morning sun. I have to squint, and he, though he faces the dark inside our house, squints back. Because I cannot think of what else to do, I reach to take the newspaper, which he hands to me. This is something, at least, but still, he does not step inside. We have seen each other only once in 15 years, but this is no product of coincidence, God forgive us. And what I think in that moment is that we both know this. I motion him in.
You seem to be, as a writer, very tuned into the kind of hurts in a family, the secrets, the darker side of families. Does that surprise you?
In a sense, because my family was a pretty good family growing up. I mean, every family will screw you up in one way or another. but as I said before, I think the pleasure of being a writer is that you can indulge the bad, and you can, in a sense, exorcise it by writing about it and by thinking about it a lot.
Do you have a kind of barometer, though, for this sort of dark side of families? Does that really sort of where your interest goes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love it. I work in the hospital a lot, and, you work in the emergency room, and I've worked in psychiatric emergency rooms. And the things the human mind is capable of are just unimaginable. And I'm fascinated by the evil and the delusion that you see in a big city emergency room.
Mm-hmm. And
the devil is always more interesting than the angel, as anybody who knows Renaissance painting will tell you.
This idea, then, of trying to understand these two brothers, is that something that really literally comes from the sort of writing part of you and the medical part of you?
Yeah, I think in some ways they convert. I think that the the sort of embrace of evil that I have and like is because I think having studied evolution, having studied biology, I really don't see it as evil. I see it in some ways as the natural order.
People have to work to be good, you mean?
We
have to
know the chicken will eat all the corn in the hen house if nobody else, no other chicken is around. It's very shaky whether there's such a thing as a benevolence gene, as a that genetics is programmed for the self and for self-survival. And so it's not horrifying for me to talk about selfishness because it seems natural order. That's where medicine comes into it. On the other hand, as a writer, one thinks a lot about morality and faith and kindness and generosity. And I think that in some ways that's an advantage, that I can look at both sides with sort of an even hand. I'm not trying to avoid the so-called darker side. Mm-hmm.
I read a quote, I think this is when you and your collection of short stories came out, that you sang, this is talking about your mother, and both your parents are, I guess your father's a violinist and mm-hmm. your mother's an artist of some sort. And you said you're probably the only Jew whose mother has ever encouraged not to go to medical school.
Yeah, those quotes, they tend to dog you.
That's a great quote. Are you going to run from that?
No, actually, it's the truth. Yeah, it's true. I was the only Jewish kid who was encouraged not to go to medical school.
Why didn't they encourage you?
My mother didn't. I think she always wanted me to be an opera singer, which is sort of funny.
Really? Can you sing?
No. But she thought it might develop. I can hold a spear. She was always a dreamer and an artistic soul. Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, my father, who was a musician, and he wanted me to get a practical job. Yeah, I think he was really saying that I didn't have very much talent. Might have been a diplomatic way of saying that.
Well, what was practical in his mind? What would be a practical job?
Oh, medicine, for example, was a very practical job. Anything that, you know, a plumber, doctor, anything that that is going to be there in good times and bad times. You know, that's one of the struggles of writing, especially in comparison to medicine, is I've got to say, you have to think, is what I'm doing any good for anybody? I can sometimes think and say, yes, writing actually does more good than medicine, at least good for more people than being a doctor. But that's a tenuous concept to really base your life on. I mean, I think it's true, and I can argue that. And enough people do also come up to me and tell me that after readings and things. But that's tough when someone has come in with a heart attack or bleeding to death and you put an IV in and save him from dying. That's pretty easy to understand why you do that. So that's sort of one of the conflicts in my life.
I think that's a question that many people ask themselves. I mean, if is what I'm doing actually going to make some difference in the world? I mean, will someone remember that I've been here?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's I think that's extremely important in the long run. I think it's of small importance day to day, but I think that adds and adds. Mm. In fact, the nicest thing about medicine is that in almost every circumstance, when you deal with your, I guess, so-called client or patient, there's sort of an implicit assumption that everything that's going on between you is for the good of the patient. And there are not many other jobs where everybody you deal with is in a benevolent way, certainly not law.
Although I think there are some that would argue with you that that it's not always such a benevolent kind of relationship.
Absolutely. That argument is very strong.
Yeah.
But there is sort of at the foundation of the profession this idea that you are there to do good and to help people. The realities of working in a big city hospital make it adversarial a lot.
Yeah.
There's just no other way to do it. There's a 14-hour waiting list in the emergency room in a lot of big city hospitals right now. People are trying to get in. People are trying to get in to get drugs. People are faking things. And you've got to sort of sort this out, and it's a very tough job. And people have this idea that doctors or psychiatrists specifically are mind readers, and they're not. They're sort of very well trained, but they've at some point the big decision a doctor has to make is, is this person sick?
My guest is writer Ethan Kanan. His new novel is called Blue River. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Ethan Kanan is my guest.
Are you interested in psychiatry?
Yeah, I am interested in psychiatry. That and neurology, and also like emergency medicine. So those three things mix.
There's something then about the, for lack of a better word, the human drama then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's fascinating. And especially with crazy people. Mm-hmm. Especially for a writer, because there's something about certain types of florid psychosis that is verbal genius. Certain manics, certain schizophrenics seem to have a grotesquely enlarged language center or something, or some fluency or lack of an internal editor that is just brilliance and poetry. And I have sat stunned as these patients will just sort of spill out this inventive, fantastic poetry without pausing, without taking a breath. And it's not planned, it's not rehearsed. You can ask them a question leading down a different path, and it comes out just as fluently. It's just stunning. It's sort of the way writing is at its very, very best when you're in some sort of dreamy state. The way that sort of right before sleep, you can produce sort of a very fluent monologue, and in some way step back from it and watch it and be aware that it's very fluent and amazing. But for these people, it happens while they're awake.
And do you find that you can carry on a conversation with someone like that who's in their own sort of reality? Because I think some people can step into that world and converse with them, and some...
I've never been able to. And I think a lot of it is it's hard to follow. It's certainly hard to interrupt, especially with certain kinds of psychosis.
Yeah.
But it's nonetheless stunning. I mean, one of the characteristics of, say, schizophrenic speech, even the words used to describe schizophrenic speech, like word salad, you know, was such a beautiful word and such sort of a deep, wonderful image that a sane person probably couldn't have invented, although I imagine a sane person did invent that.
Yeah.
But I imagine that was heard. I imagine a psychotic person first said that.
Do you find yourself then sort of consciously paying attention to this? I mean, thinking that somehow this stream of consciousness, that their world can somehow get into your imagination.
Yeah, it's more as though that's what I strive for in a way. And you know, a writer, almost all writers I know have this experience of saying that people are asked where do their characters come from, and almost all writers I know will say, "Oh, their voices in my head."
Yeah, right.
And that, of course, is the hallmark of psychosis, is hearing voices. And I think in some ways, a writer is the second step on this continuum, where a crazy person is the third, and a writer somehow is able to turn it off and go make coffee and pay his bills, and a crazy person is not. And I know plenty of writers, especially poets, who move in and out of craziness.
Well, that reminds me of something that Ruth Stone, who's a poet, said to me, and this was actually when she was very little. She said she could feel a poem coming towards her. She said it was as if it was a freight train just barreling, you know, down the street towards her, and she literally had to drop what she was doing and wait for it.
Amazing, amazing. And I feel some of that. I would say mine's not a freight train. I'd say mine's maybe a small import.
Hyundai.
Yeah, Hyundai coming at me. And one of the characteristics of the so-called healthy mind, another thing you learn in neurology, is the ability to shift set, is what it's called. You can, when you want, think about what you want, no matter what's going on around you. Your mind can wander. You can dream. Of course, a lot of people try to stop their daydreams, not realizing that it's sort of the hallmark of a healthy, functioning mind. And I think maybe what she's talking about is this somewhere on the continuum of not being able to shift set, of hearing those voices. Luckily, she's able to, in the end, pay her rent. But it's a horribly frightening thing. Imagine that, not being able to control what you think about.
Ethan Kanan is my guest, and he is a writer and also a medical student, and is finishing his fourth year at Harvard Medical School. Did you show an aptitude for math and science? I mean, your father wanted you to take something practical to be a physician.
Yeah, I wanted to be a mathematician. I was an engineering major for the first 3 years of college. I thought all this other stuff was weak-minded, uninteresting. And to me, it was then. And I can't imagine what I saw in the other stuff now. No, I still love all that stuff, and I still love, you know, brain teasers and things like that. But to spend one's life, I can't imagine anything more interesting than human character.
Well, how then did you then make this switch to writing? I mean, where did writing become more compelling to you?
To tell you the truth, I took a creative writing class in my junior year in college, sort of on a lark, liked it. And
surprised yourself then?
Yeah, wrote a horrible story and then wrote a pretty good story, and got some support for it. The teacher helped me a lot, and that was that. And I published that story, and then I had to write another one. And you know, once you get something published, it is such a thrill that you'll do anything to do it again. And and since then, it has grown. Actually, it's what Saul Bellow says: a writer is a reader moved to emulation. Is something I believe in, and I'm so moved, I think, when I read or when I read something good, that I want to do that. I hate to write, but I feel I cannot not do it.
You mean that you hate to write?
Oh yeah, I hate it.
Because it's hard, right?
Oh yeah, it's terribly hard. There are the moments I like. It's very similar to jogging, and it's very hard to start. And as soon as you get that so-called endorphin rush that everybody talks
that
about.
Elusive that elusive
endorphin rush that I've heard about, haven't yet found. No, actually, I have found it a couple of times in my probably dozen times I've jogged. Then it's pleasurable, but it's so painful up to that point. And that occurs, that's maybe 5 minutes a day. But other than that, no, I hate it.
Well,
it's horrible.
Is that why you went to medical school thinking this is the writer's life is just too damn difficult?
That's a lot of why I did it. The writer's life is just too difficult. And in many ways, it's the easiest life imaginable because you can wear what you want, you can wake up what you want, when you want. But knowing both those worlds, knowing the opposite world, when you got to be there at 4:30 in the morning in the hospital and work all night, I know that's an easier life, actually.
Do you think people make too much of a big deal about the fact that you're a writer and soon to be physician as well?
I'm asked about it fairly often.
Yeah.
I don't think medicine is a particularly fictional field. Maybe people often ask me if I'll write about medicine. And for some reason, I don't want to. I think it's too unsubtle. Mm-hmm. I think life and death is too easy. And it's the smaller decisions and the smaller betrayals that are a lot more interesting.
Writer and medical student Ethan Kanan. His new novel is called Blue River. This is Fresh Air. Here's a look at what's coming up later on All Things Considered. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports on the continuing controversy surrounding the Bush administration's stand on civil rights. The president signed the civil rights bill into law today, but many Democrats still have doubts. Tom Jelton reports on the deteriorating conditions in the Croatian region of Yugoslavia. The Serbian-backed federal army continues to close in on Croatian strongholds throughout the country. Also, a look at the effect of economic sanctions on Haiti. Many foreign businesses have now permanently closed their operations in the country. All that, plus letters from listeners, coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, the National Book Award for Poetry was given to Philip Levine's collection, What Work Is. It's the first time in 7 years that the National Book Foundation has given its award in the poetry category. Critic Maureen Corrigan has noticed that the form often gets short shrift. She has a review of two new collections by two major poets, Atlas of a Difficult World by Adrienne Rich, which was a nominee for the National Book Award, and Seeing Things by Irish poet Seamus Heaney.
One of my favorite poets, Stevie Smith, remarked in the 1950s that, as far as the public goes, poetry might be one of those railroad branch lines scheduled for closing. Well, by now Smith's metaphor is also outmoded, but you get her message. And yet, even though poetry has been abandoned by most readers, whenever anything momentous happens, suddenly poetry seems necessary again. One of the strangest side effects of the Gulf War was the mass resurrection of World War I poetry. Everywhere you turned, newspaper and TV reporters were quoting Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon. Somehow only their poetry could adequately convey the horror of poison gas warfare. To fall back on Smith's railroad metaphor, we still depend on the wheezing engine of poetry to carry us into difficult territory. Throughout the 40-year career of Audrian Rich, she's taken her readers through the rocky landscapes of contemporary history. Rich has never been afraid of being too topical. She doesn't worry about whether or not her poems will endure. That's the future's problem. In Atlas of a Difficult World, Rich continues to shoulder the political poetic burden first taken up by Walt Whitman. There are up-to-the-minute poems here about the Gulf War and the Recession. One extraordinary poem memorializes Rebecca White, a lesbian who was murdered in 1988 while she was on a camping trip with her lover. Rich recalls that the murderer's defense was that the two women had teased his loathing of what they were. Rich's poems confront rather than escape from a difficult world. I hope she's at work right now on a poem that'll help us figure out the David Duke phenomenon. If Rich maps out politics and social issues, Seamus Heaney's poetry excavates the ancient foundation of our everyday lives. 15 years ago, Robert Lowell christened Heaney the best Irish poet since Yeats. Apparently, Heaney would prefer that people forget this enormous compliment. It's too much to live up to. But in his new collection, Seeing Things, Heaney demonstrates once again why the Yeats comparison is unavoidable. Heaney creates his poetry out of classical myths, Irish politics and legends, and ordinary objects, things like shaving mirrors, bacon, and rat poison. This eclectic list of poetic ingredients is straight out of Yeats's Foul Rag and Bone Shop, the place where Yeats, just before he died, said he wanted his poetry to return. It's hard not to think of Heaney as some kind of earthier reincarnation of Yeats. Seeing Things is less erotic than Heaney's other collections, maybe because it's obsessed with the dead. The book opens with a traditional poem about Aeneas's journey to the underworld to see his father. The poems that follow are haunted by the shades of Heaney's dead friends, like Philip Larkin, and by the ghost of Heaney's own father. The brief poem, An August Night, reads, "His hands were warm and small and knowledgeable. When I saw them again last night, they were two ferrets playing all by themselves in a moonlit field." In another poem, Heaney remembers leaving the family farmhouse after his father's death. He describes the house as a rebuke to fanciness and a shrine to limit. That's not a bad description of Heaney's own poetry, a shrine to limit. If Seeing Things had been published a century earlier, we'd all be worshippers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed new poetry collections by Audrian Rich and Seamus Heaney. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Norman Lear's TV series pushed the envelope of what you could say on television. On the next edition of Fresh Air, the creator of All in the Family talks about fighting for free speech on TV and off. Also, we meet Glenn Keane, the chief animator for Disney's new cartoon movie, Beauty and the Beast. That and more on the next Fresh Air.